as Anthony said, I'm the editor of this book. It was published earlier this year, called Eco Art History in East and Southeast Asia. More generally, my remarks tonight are spurred by the perils of climate change, of human actions that put Earth systems, which support life, in jeopardy. The burning of fossil fuels, the loss of polar ice caps and glaciers, the loss of wildlife habitat, rising temperatures and extreme weather and so forth have led to my own reflection about my own complicity in this terrible situation. These phenomena have also led me to wonder seriously about the relevancy of my field, art history. Art history has long been a field tied to structures of power, wealth, and extreme privilege, all of which have had as their foundation a carbon economy. A carbon economy is one that controls and extracts and burns fossil fuels, and these are what drive climate change. I doubt that complete disentanglement from those structures is feasible, but I do think it's possible to introduce new themes and strategies into art history that grapple seriously with climate change. What role does Asia play in this regard? Asia is home to great concentrations of people who are vulnerable to the effects of climate change. And as you can see from this slide, more people live inside that circle than outside of it. So in terms of sheer numbers, Asia matters. And as it turns out, a great percentage of those people in Asia are among the most vulnerable to climate change. Bangladesh, for example, much of it is kind of below sea level or soon to be below sea level. So Asia matters. Also, I think Asia matters because there's a long history or a long historical record of anthropogenic change. That is, changes to the landscape, to water systems that are human-made. Sedentary agriculture and the retreat of the elephants in Chinese regions this has been taking place for millennia. And if we want to grapple seriously with climate change, we cannot maintain a narrative centered on just the West and its skewed emphasis, if not obsession, on the Industrial Revolution. Right? And I do fault the Industrial Revolution, to be sure, but there are other places in which anthropogenic change has been a factor, and that's what this slide is about. This image of a manor, of an estate, was painted in the 11th century, maybe the early 12th, but probably more like the late 11th century. And it is a contrast to what people typically think of when they hear the words Chinese landscape painting. People will typically think of something like this. This is Guo Xi's Early Spring from the year 1072, a court production, which is meant to demonstrate magnificent sheer towering peaks and a kind of natural circumstance that is ideal and with very little human intervention. The human beings in this painting are confined to the foreground, and they are small so as to be almost invisible. Here we have a small kind of family group of fishermen and wives and children. In another detail in the painting over here, there is a temple complex. I actually forgot to point out, in this detail, there is a scholar on a mule or donkey and then a servant who's bringing luggage. But as you can see from the slide of the overall painting, the human beings are very few, and it seems almost as if their presence is a harmonious part of the world. And then we are led to believe that the pre-modern Chinese probably had some sort of harmonious relationship with nature, that they appreciated nature. And I think that there are other landscape paintings that tell us that this is not true. This painting is not a court production, but done by a scholar painter named Li Gonglin at about the same time as Early Spring. And here you can see from a kind of bird's eye view that he has created an estate, very large, situated amongst the mountains, and then in front of his estate in the kind of riverine valley are all of these many rice fields, well over 200 of them. And so Li Gonglin has dramatically altered this landscape, and it suggests a different kind of relationship in pre-modern China. that really people are there to cut down forests and create estates and to plant fields. So here is kind of a contrast of these two kinds of landscapes, which then should make clear that it's really only one type of landscape that is most prominently featured in art histories. Only one landscape is prominently featured in museums. And so it creates a kind of false impression of Asia as a place prior to the entry of the West, as a place of pristine natural environments, or a place populated by individuals who with their Taoist inclinations, might really respect nature or appreciate it in a way that modern Westerners do not. Right? So I want to just suggest that this is false. Okay, so that kind of is a way to start thinking about Asia, the importance of Asia, a little bit about art history, and then a little bit about climate change. And what I want to do now is just give you an overview of the anthology that I put together. So I'll talk a little bit about each of the essays and then suggest the kinds of challenges that the individual authors effectively pose to art history in their projects. So the first couple of essays are both located in the Joseon period of Korea, so 18th and 19th century. It was a time when unprecedented environmental problems faced the Joseon kings, and it was also a time when new approaches to understanding the natural world rivaled long-standing conventions of knowledge. Here I pulled two images, one from each of those essays. So Sue M. McCormick is the author of the first essay called Rereading Imagery of Tilling and Weaving in the Context of the Little Ice Age. She focuses on images depicting these paired activities of growing rice and making silk in the late 18th centuries. Such paintings, such as this one by Kim Hong-do, this well-celebrated Korean painter. Such paintings have heretofore been analyzed within the context of genre painting, or in Korean, sokwa. Representing the mundane activities of labor and leisure, sokwa developed hand-in-hand with a growing interest in local phenomena and a tendency towards realism. Immediacy, whether in terms of the spatial proximity or instantaneous recognition of everyday experience, characterizes both the subject and the style of sokwa. And subsequently, these qualities have fueled interpretations of paintings of tilling and weaving as developed documents of Joseon prosperity. Right? So in other words, it's a kind of East Asian equivalent to the happy peasant images of maybe pre-modern or early modern Europe. Moreover, in implicit competition with an art history championing the West as having arrived first at modernism's finish line, sokwa, from this kind of Korean art historical perspective, is proof that another contestant may have reached that destination earlier. However appealing this interpretation may be, it overlooks critical conditions caused by the Little Ice Age. Contrary to the idealized images of industry and industriousness in sokwa, the reigns of kings Yongzhou and Zhongzhou were marked by severe cold, crop failures, famine, disease, and unrest. And as my students are kind of obsessed by the fact, also cannibalism. It's always the gory things that attract attention. Sue McCormick draws the indirect but nevertheless operative connection between environmental conditions and artistic subject matter. Her essay reveals a history of images of tilling and weaving in Joseon, Korea that focuses on transmission from the Qing Dynasty court. Here are some other images. This is the Qing Dynasty court image. It's a woodblock copy of pictures of tilling and weaving. And at the time, the Joseon court had requested and received famine relief from the Qing emperor. So McCormick restores to the examination of agriculturally themed sokwa a kind of complex and dynamic interaction of environmental conditions on the one hand, its socioeconomic effects, and then finally political actions. So in this context, she reveals that these artworks are not kind of transparent representations of a harmonious and kind of thriving society. Rather, they are a medium for diplomacy. They are a medium for instruction and encouragement to celebrate moderation and frugality. They also propagate particular kinds of attitudes, suggesting that the Joseon kings were themselves they had legitimacy in their rule, right? That they subscribed to such Confucian values and that they were sympathetic to the plight of the people. The other essay that focuses on painting of Joseon Korea is by Nathaniel Kingdon. And what he does is present further insights into the intersection of environment and art in the early 19th century. This is a moment when empirical observation figured increasingly in creating knowledge among scholars and painters at the Joseon court. Kingdon takes as his case studies textual and visual representations of aquatic creatures. In 1814, scholar Jong Yak-jun completed a registry of fish he observed while exiled to the remote island of Hokusando. Chung's earlier draft included illustrations, but he was persuaded by his brother's criticism that pictures were, quote, shallow. He should abandon those images in favor of text alone. So Chung's registry of fishes actually eliminated all the pictures. Kingdon is interested in then trying to figure out what goes missing when you no longer have pictures. And as it turns out, Chung had an almost exact contemporary painter in this artist, Zhang Hanzhong, who seems to have created images of fish and other aquatic creatures from a kind of empirical perspective. So here I'm showing a detail now of that panel. And from that one panel, which you see on the right, I then have circled and created yet another detail, which you see now on the left, with a crab and some flatfish and other creatures. And as that turns out, these fish in Zhang's panel, most of the 60-odd fish have been identified by their exact species, which is a really different situation than trying to match just textual descriptions. Both the painter, and here's yet another example of that painter's artwork, both the painter and the scholar leave behind a kind of Confucian attitude to creating knowledge. The Confucian attitude privileged words and it privileged textual references to literature and other kinds of precedents. By contrast, both the scholar and the painter are using empirical experience to try and describe, whether in words or pictures, the shape, the texture, the behavior, the size, the scale of all of these fish. And as it turns out, Zhang's here's actually how Zhang the painter departs, whereas earlier painters, and this is Kim Hong-do yet again, describe crabs here in a kind of calligraphic way. It's quite abstract, and it uses crabs not so much as kind of independent creatures in and of themselves, but rather as a creature whose spoken name is a homonym that wishes a kind of that offers someone an auspicious wish. Right, so really the crabs here are almost just merely symbolic as opposed to being empirically observed, right? And here you can kind of see in this detail how very carefully Zhang describes the crab on the right-hand side. Like if you saw that crab, you could identify it on the beach. Whereas if you saw the crabs by Kim Hong-do on the left-hand side, it could be any crab. It really doesn't matter to him. What's interesting is that at roughly the same time in Europe, empiricism and an empirical approach to understanding the natural world is something that is happening in kind of proto-scientific knowledge creation. And in Europe, images are paired very closely with text so that one could grasp that creature, that species, both visually and textually. And Kingdon makes the case that because Confucian principles persuaded Zhong the scholar to eliminate the text, one gets only, quote, half the picture. One either gets the text or one gets the image. And if the two had been brought together, how much more would scholars know? Now, these two essays that kind of start out the volume, it seems to me, create some challenges, right? They present new ways to look at painting that we already know about from a couple hundred years or more ago. Instead of looking at the painting in terms of symbolism or as just gifts, both of these art historians are trying to bring to bear natural science or climate. And so what they do is expand the context of understanding art. I think the challenge in terms of doing that is trying to balance the background information. And as I'm teaching these essays, students have a kind of expectation now where they study art. They can expect to study political context. They can expect to study identity politics. They do not necessarily expect to be in the classroom and start learning about natural sciences or the history of science. So I think that's an interesting kind of challenge, but I think it's an important one to tackle when we live in a situation that we do with these kind of extreme weather events, and that science does increasingly, I think, bear on socioeconomic systems. Okay. Shifting from the late 18th centuries and the 19th century in the Korean Peninsula, the next three essays in the anthology examine contemporary art, and they necessarily recognize its inherently global dimensions. And here I just have images from each of the three kind of central essays. Midori Yamamura, who's here in the audience today, just want to thank her for her contribution and let you know that she's here if you want to know more about Roberto Villanueva's work. She examines his work, a Filipino artist doing work in, or having a work done in Japan posthumously. I am interested in Zhang Hongtu's paintings, and that's represented by the middle image. And Zhang is a Chinese-American artist now. At any rate, he lives and works in Queens. And then finally, Lucy Davis, a printmaker who lives in the Southeast Asia, and that's her artwork on the right-hand side. She traces migrations of wood and woodcut artists in the Southeast Asian archipelagos. So although separated by great distances and working in different mediums, each of the artists in question, Roberto, then Zhang, and then Lucy Davis, each of these artists grapple with present problems of the Anthropocene. These three essays are also informed by the author's kind of particular interest, curatorial, pedagogical, or as a practicing artist, respectively. And they suggest to us the diversity of perspectives for writing eco-art history. So Midori Yamamura traces the intersection of indigenous aesthetics and environmental themes in the monumental but ephemeral art of Filipino artist Roberto Villanueva. Inviting audience participation in rituals, Roberto's therapeutic strategies culminated in a posthumous project designed to heal the planet. It's called Sacred Sanctuary, Acupuncture of the Earth. And that's a sketch that you see here for that work. Oh. And then a photograph of the artist on the right-hand side doing a different work not too far from here, I think. Oh, actually, sorry, that's in Brisbane, but I think he also did something in the New York area. The history behind his project of a sacred sanctuary acupuncture of the earth includes Roberto's personal experience of battling leukemia, which may have possibly been caused by exposure to radioactive waste, which Japan was sending to other areas of Southeast Asia. That work also draws on a history of colonialism, which had exploited natural abundance in the Philippines and degraded its environment. Roberto's earlier work took issue with the poisoning of rivers, illegal logging operations, and the negative impacts of Sweden architecture, which is flash and burning. He saw hope, though, in indigenous practices of forest preservation, and he shifted his energies to local arts communities. His late work not only reveals the problems and their history, but it also adopts an ethics of how impact of low impact on the earth, combined with audience collaboration toward positive sociopolitical change, enacting what Yamamura calls a sustainability aesthetics. Roberto did not live to see the staging of Sacred Sanctuary, Acupuncture the Earth, but the artwork was realized posthumously at the symbolic location that he specified, Hiroshima. Yamamura rekindles the memory of his bold project, challenging us to forge art systems that likewise resist capitalist circuits and their ruinous planet-wide effects. This is an image by Zhang Hongtu and part of the essay that I wrote. I was interested in how Chinese contemporary artists have been referencing canonical Chinese landscapes as a rhetorical strategy for anthropogenic changes. And this is something that Zhang Hongtu also does. So he is my case study. This painting that I showed you now in kind of smaller form is from his Repaint Shanshui series, or Shanshui Today series. And what he does is he takes canonical Chinese landscapes, such as the one on the upper left. This is from the Southern Song period, or I'm going to say early 13th century. He takes that basic composition and redoes them in the style of someone else, in this case Monet. So that's one change. A second change is that he does the painting in oils or in acrylic. So that's a second change in medium. And then finally, he adds some sort of anthropogenic consequence, in this case in the foreground. I'll go back to this detail. You'll see dead fish who are floating at the surface in the foreground. So oftentimes when you see these kinds of paintings, and here's another example. This is Zhang Hongtu doing Wind in the Pines. Again, a Song Dynasty painting on the right-hand side. But in Zhang Hongtu's version of it, the trees have been cut down. And so all you have left are kind of matchsticks and stumps and so forth, instead of actual pine trees through which you may actually hear the wind blowing. And here's kind of one more. Now, let me stick with this one. What these kinds of images do, and there are a number of other contemporary Chinese artists who are kind of referencing canonical paintings in this way, what this does is it kind of sets up a before and after situation, where one then imagines that before there was a kind of pristine natural environment and an ideal landscape, right? And then the after is today, and a kind of situation of pollution and degraded environments, or, you know, loss of habitat and so forth. My point here is I appreciate the rhetorical gesture, but there's also kind of inherent falsehood that is created. That really, in the Song Dynasty, the landscape was hardly pristine, which was what I wanted to say earlier. And if we look instead at some of other Zhang Hongtu's works, we can maybe chip away at that fallacy. So here's another one of Zhang Hongtu's work. This is repainting a Qing Dynasty work. So the Qing Dynasty work is now down below, and you can kind of match the composition and so forth. And with Zhang's point with this one is that, oh, the waters are now polluted, the people have now disappeared, the polluted waters probably generate a kind of stench and make it inhospitable. And so the landscape is a little bit barren. There's just the houses are left, but not so much the people who are enjoying the river. But when you look at this earlier painting, for a lot of art historians, if you dig a little deeper, this actually is not even the kind of, quote, original reference. The original reference is a Tang Dynasty painting that is now lost, and we have only its composition preserved through rubbings that were taken from a kind of inscribed representation of Wang Wei's estate. So you have to kind of go back. If you peel away the layers and you think of Zhang as doing something now based on a Qing Dynasty painting, so that would have been 18th century. But that painter actually doing something that is based on the memory of a Tang Dynasty or 7th century painting, you now begin to get a kind of art historical sequence. And I hope what one realizes by doing the art historical sequence is that really the pristine environment, if there ever was one, was much longer ago, right? Much longer ago. And that these are all kind of manufactured or built environments already. I think Zhang's work is extraordinary and really, really interesting in that he really has a kind of generous, open attitude towards a lot of his work, and a lot of what he's trying to do is kind of bridge boundaries. In this earlier kind of repaint Shanshui work, what he's trying to do here is bridging boundaries between a kind of Western art historical tradition and the canon in which we would find Vincent van Gogh, and then the Chinese landscape canon where we would find the Guoxi, right? So his work is on the left-hand side. It takes Guoxi's composition and then redoes it in a kind of Van Gogh style. This kind of hybridity, I think, is something that he's also interested, not just in terms of cultures, but also in terms of trying to bridging a gap between people or human beings on the one hand, and then creatures or animals on the other hand. This was an image that he did, I think, in about the 80s or 90s when he came to the U.S., of these fish. They're kind of all kind of crammed in together. They seem really ghostly, and they kind of confront the viewer as if they had some kind of strange residual kind of human consciousness or some kind of consciousness, right? And he did see these fish as a kind of self-portrait for himself, right? And you can see his own self-portrait. He's really interested in kind of crossing boundaries. So I think what's another kind of interesting aspect of his work for the thinking about Anthropocene and thinking about equal art history is that he kind of destabilizes the human being at the center, right? And I think one of the goals of equal art history is to try and take a non-anthropocentric, or to get away from anthropocentrism, and try and see the world in a different way. And I think a lot of these images that he does with monkeys actually do that, that the monkeys in the foreground basically function as a kind of animal proxy for the human audience. After all, these monkeys are looking out in the landscape, and so they are replicating our very own actions right now. And what they see in the landscape is the residual bit of the CCTV building. So you might know this strange, it seems to be kind of a strange iceberg or some sort of other mountain, right, in this watery landscape. But this is the form of the CCTV building in Beijing, and it has an interesting form. So I think this kind of landscape then compels us, or it challenges us and asks us, do you identify with the CCTV building because you're a human being and that's part of your culture or your construction, and you identify as modern and urban? Or do you identify with the monkeys, these kinds of creatures that are looking out in a way that is not fully accessible, but somehow a little bit familiar? I think this is maybe one kind of culmination of his series that involved monkeys, because he took his granddaughter's photograph and actually grafted onto this blue kind of monkey body. Right? And so I think he really is trying to be sympathetic. I think there are times when it seems really sentimental, but that's another lecture or another thought. Okay, the third of the middle essays is by practicing artist Lucy Davis. And what she does is investigate the intersecting lives of individuals and human populations on the one hand, and of trees. So if it was a stretch to kind of sympathize with a monkey or another kind of animal, she stretches us even more. And she tries to sympathize or try to take the perspective of trees and wood and forests. So art and artistic practices mediate between the two, and they take the form of woodcut prints. For her, spiritual and shamanic activities. She also scours the back streets for discarded wood furniture, and she enlists the services of a private company to interpret DNA wood samples. She's interested in photographic portraits of tree wounds, wood print collages. She makes an animated film, and she does a mixed media installation. So there's a kind of whole journey that's encapsulated in her project. Her project begins when she actually goes to an exhibition of Malaysian woodcut, or Malaysian Chinese woodcut print artists, and she sees work like this one of Nanyang University. And she's interested in the fact that it's a woodcut in the medium itself, and she's also interested in what is being represented within the woodcut, in this case, wooden scaffolding or bamboo scaffolding. Right. This is another print from the mid-20th century that she found really interesting. And it certainly does feature two gentlemen, right, and a sense of an activity of persuading and a kind of ambivalence on the younger man. But Lucy Davis then looks really kind of closely, and she sees an interesting kind of echo in the older man's hands and gestures with this frangipani tree, which seems to embrace the two, and its leaves, too, seem to have this finger-like quality, right? So she sees that wood as being really animated and having some agency of its own. So she's searching for an artistic expression that responds to non-human narratives of wood. Artistic expression that resists simple-minded advocacy and pays homage to the mid-20th century Malayan modern woodblock movement. All right, so here is actually a print by Lucy Davis herself. And it's the result of having kind of scavenged in these alleys in Singapore where people leave out used stuff. And so what she found is this a stool, a wooden stool. She didn't want to use new wood because she didn't want to contribute to the consumption of new wood. So she was already thinking, I'm going to use wood and I'll recycle it for my prints. But once she acquired the stool, she actually found it really difficult, really violent to then gouge into the wood. So instead, she actually prints each face and every element of that wooden stool. She eventually comes across a bed, and she kind of traces this bed, and you can kind of see this tiny little bit of the bed frame right here in the lower right-hand side of that print. She eventually finds this bed made of teak, and she becomes really interested in trying to find where that teak originally came from. And so she goes on this journey to try and find it, and at the same time, she's interested in printing from that wood made of that bed. And so what she ends up with is a body of work that includes these enormous woodblock print collages. So this print is, I guess I didn't write it down here, I think 240 centimeters high. And it consists of individual tiny prints from parts of the bed kind of all assembled together. Right, so she goes to this kind of reconstructing the tree from the parts of the bed idea. That also fuels a animated film that she has, and the upper right-hand image right now is a still from that image, which involves a bird that consumes figs and will probably leave fig seeds all around there, and that relates to the image on the left-hand side because there's a strangler fig tree that will eventually kind of consume the teak tree. And then finally, she also does these installations, and if you looked really carefully at that Malayan wood block print, the first one I showed you from the mid-20th century, you could see echoes of that in the silhouette against that back wall. Here, if I bring it back, now you can kind of see the contours there. So she kind of recreates that scaffolding, that structure. And then there are these kind of tiny windows that you look through, and you can see here that she's kind of recreated that other scene about persuading. There's that persuading. So that's kind of a little bit about her work and how she kind of approaches it as a practicing artist. All right, the final two essays in the volume are by Sonia Lee and Gregory Levine. It's kind of coincidental. They both deal with Buddhist sites, so these are just a couple of images from their essays. The commonality in their essays is really not so much that they're looking at Buddhist sculpture, but that they're interested in cultural heritage and the complex ecological challenges that they pose to their constituencies and that they pose to art history. So they examine sites in China and in Thailand, respectively. Their essays bridge the past and the present, And they really challenge us to re-examine the underlying values that govern our attitudes and our inclinations to preserve the past. So I'll take Sonia Lee's essay first. She examines the Nankan Scenic area in northern Sichuan province where Buddhist cliffside carvings dating to the 7th century and the museum of the Sichuan and Shanxi revolutionary base. Oh, I guess I don't have a frontispiece of that. Anyway, here's a map to kind of show you the two parts. That revolutionary museum features artifacts from the 1930s, right? So Buddhist art from the 7th century, kind of artifacts from the communist revolution, revolutionary areas like from the 1930s, they make strange bedfellows. And together, it's a heritage site. So for the Chinese government and its culture industry, however, the material remains of the region's remote religious history and its near political past offer a singularly attractive opportunity to balance the contradictions of a consumer-based economy within a communist regime. And in analyzing the use and uneven distribution of resources, natural and otherwise, of the Nankan Scenic Area, Lee adopts a method that she calls art historical ecology. By doing so, she illuminates a complex political economy of cultural heritage, but also extends it to include concern for the site's natural environment and sustainability. The political economy that generated the Nankan Scenic Area in that story, the art historians played a key role by undertaking research and producing scholarship, which demonstrated historical value and justified petitions to the state for recognition. Against the backdrop of the World Heritage System and the international prestige granted by UNESCO, Lee reveals how the creation of, quote, cultural heritage, this process in China that requires the work of scholars, the promotion of local party members, and the sponsorship of high-level political communities, the approval of international bodies, and the coordinated construction of infrastructure and other physical changes to the site, not to mention the daily operation of the resulting attraction, right? It facilitates a kind of development and politics, consumer demands, and party priorities, right? All of those things together. When granted the moniker cultural heritage, a site undergoes marked transformation so that in contrast to centuries past, the religious practice had motivated viewers to sponsor additions to and renewal of the Buddhist cliff carvings, for example. So the kind of paint that you see here on this Vairochana Buddha like clearly does not date to the year 877 when it was initially carved. Instead, for centuries, the tradition was that you could renew carving by painting it, or you could refurbish, and then that was a way to actually earn spiritual or kind of karmic spiritual positive marks on your karmic record from the Buddhist perspective. But now, with the kind of the UNESCO designation, that kind of change is no longer allowed. But instead, you can build this massive infrastructure, which constitutes a different kind of change, right? Really unprecedented physical changes. So visitors, they are forbidden to sponsor changes to the cliff, but site managers undertake massive adjustments to landscaping in the name of visitor amenities. Here's the entrance to the Revolutionary Museum. All right, still, Lee reasons, visitors may regain a measure of agency as they now constitute in toto the determinant of the site's kind of viability, economic and otherwise. All right, the last essay in the anthology is by Gregor Levine, and he's interested in viability as well when he probes the meaning of tree Buddhas near Wat Mahathat in Ayutthaya in Thailand. So for Levine, these conjoined arboreal and human-made entities offer a case study for confronting realities that art history's anthropocentric orientation has dangerously obscured. Art history's conventional narratives of human exceptionalism disavow the field's basis and complicity in that destructive carbon economy, and such narratives are blind to the biosphere. So he borrows a term from Amitav Ghosh and sees art history as engaged in experiencing a great derangement. It facilitates a kind of art history as usual despite the alarming changes, signs of climate change and biospheric collapse. So to begin writing an art history free of derangement, Levine resists isolating this the human made component of the Buddha and the tree, right, and analyzing it just conventionally according to its date or iconography, style, and so forth, even patronage. Instead, he tries to attend to both the head and the tree as a conjoined object, right? So, kind of starting at the very beginning. So, Buddha, head in a tree confounds even before the analysis begins. Should the art historian begin by describing the head or the tree? And Levine wrestles with this distinction to point out deep-seated priorities that have shaped art historical inquiry before he applies the methods of art history to unpack the histories and significance of the sculpted head and the ficus tree. So some of his analysis includes thinking about Buddhism and the kind of joining of Buddhist imagery and aspects of tree, right? So in one image, you have the Buddhist monk kind of carving a Buddha into Buddha face into a tree, and that's the left-hand side. And then on the right-hand side, you have a kind of that heart-shaped ficus leaf as the ground for a Buddhist painting. So he kind of looks at these kinds of things, but ultimately, he is trying to get beyond anthropocentrism, and he tries to see the tree as tree. And in doing so, he kind of looks to botany and to ecology to defamiliarize the tree Buddha and to reveal the artifice of human sign systems for understanding the tree. And he tries to attempt an arboreocentric narrative. At that point, I think there are kind of interesting parallels between between Lucy Davis's attempt to kind of see sympathetic through the tree, or see sympathetic or work sympathetically with the wood, and I think Gregory Levine is trying to do a kind of wood-centered or tree-centered, potentially, art history. So Levine restores agency to this and other specimens of the ficus religiosa, sometimes called strangler figs, for their capacity to colonize human-built structures. And that kind of colonization takes place in a site such as this one, in which people traditionally kind of lament the destruction of the kind of, quote, art object. But of course, when it comes to the art object, the Buddha in a tree is really kind of singled out for the very fact that it is part tree. So while art history has tended to lament and then to prevent or circumvent the loss of art, he calls for a recognition that there never was any such thing but loss, or he thinks of it more accurately as a symbolic or symbiotic becoming and making with. So he recognizes this reality regarding material artistic entities, and he enjoins us to reimagine art history by attending to the biovisuality of the non-human as it alters human-made objects and kind of creeps into our visual experience. So overall, like for the project as a whole, it tries to reimagine art history. And in the age of climate change and the impacts of the Anthropocene, I think we are facing really new, daunting questions, and the reckoning is going to be different for everyone. We all bear a measure of responsibility, right, as human beings, and this anthology and the authors, I think, try to find ways in which art history, a field of human inquiry predicated on careful observation, can help to reveal rather than to obscure with greater accuracy the scope and the complexity of the problems before us. And then one hopes to guide the thinking that would generate the solutions. So that's what I have for you this evening. I would be happy to answer questions or kind of hear your comments and your thoughts as well, because this eco-art history is a really new kind of subfield within art history, just getting started, particularly when it comes to areas of the world, art productions other than the American West, where I think there's probably been a generation of art historians doing this work.